Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is David Messenbring and wife Maria Jimenez. Climb boldly, finding God out on a limb. Ministry at Seafarer's House in Port Everglade, Florida. Let's listen in.
I'm David Messenbring, and I'm joined by my spouse and colleague at Seafarer's House, Maria Jimenez. Our series is entitled Climb Boldly, Finding God Out on a Limb. And particularly, we're looking at limbs that are either scary looking or foreign looking, or in this case, almost invisible. Seafarers and migrant farm workers, I think, are the two groups of people in our society that we depend on the most every day and think about the least. And maybe seafarers even less than farm workers, since there's been some attention given to their situation over the last decade or two. But merchant seafarers, who carry 95% of the world's commerce, don't get much play in our society. And we did a session last week. How many of you were present for that? A couple of faces, three? Which was on generically about maritime ministry in general. And today's focus is on the ministry at Seafarer's House, which Maria founded and we have developed together since 1991. I want to just ask if any of you are familiar with Port Everglades. Anybody been through Port Everglades? Nobody? You've been close. You've cruised out of the Port of Miami twice. Port Everglades is the second largest cruise port in the world. The big cruise ports in North America are Miami, number one. Puerto Rico gets more ships, but more people actually board a cruise. They embark or disembark in Port Everglades than in San Juan, Puerto Rico. But San Juan, Miami, and Port Everglades, which is Fort Lauderdale's port, just 22 miles from Miami, are the three big cruise ports. Although Port Everglades is not only a cruise port, it was the fastest growing container port in the country a couple of years ago. It handles a massive amount of import-export to the Caribbean and Central and South America. A lot of the clothing you wear leaves Port Everglades as fabric, and then returns through Port Everglades after it's been sewn together in Dominican Republic or Honduras or places like that. And then it has a very important regional influence. For example, all the petroleum in South Florida comes through Port Everglades, all the lumber, all the cement. So it's an important commercial port, both for its cargo and also for its crews. From a port chaplain's point of view, 20 people work on a cargo ship, but 800 or 900 on a cruise ship. So as far as taking care of souls, the fact that it's a cruise port makes a big, big difference to the kind of work we do. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Maria to talk a little bit about who the seafarers are and what they need from us.
First of all, I've been working with seafarers. We use the term seafarers to include women. We thought that seaman or seaman was kind of rough, rude for women who are also part of cruise ships or cargo ships. So often I get in trouble with people. They don't know what seafarers are. It's an old term, but we're advocating for that inclusive term in among other agencies, national and international, because most of the centers that work with seafarers are called International Seamen Center, and use the seamen quite a lot. But as I said, I've been working for, it's gonna be 10 years, and I'm very privileged to be with people from all nations and to hear their stories, their fascinating stories. And I just want to share a little bit with you what are their needs. As David was mentioning, the seafarers are the invisible labor who provide and help us with mostly all the things we enjoy, from cars to clothes, from toys to food. Everything is come by the ocean, from the ocean, from other countries. And seafarers are exposed to a lot of dangers and hard life because their wages are very low. It's similar to what a migrant worker would earn. And they're subject to spending a long, long time away from home, as much as 3 years. I've met crew members on a ship. They've been there for 3 years without leaving the ship. And I say, why? But, well, I want to build a house. I want to build my own house in the Philippines. And if I don't do this, we don't have a home. So they're there just to make a living out somewhere else. But I was wondering, because this was a tanker ship, and the kind of fumes and life, or all men and all these very strict rules on board, and for 3 years, that man, when he comes home, must be very unfit for the community. Should psychologically must be very, very difficult to adjust to the family, and then I heard that when adjust to the family, they're always missing the ship because they're used to that close quarters, and their movements are sort of accustomed to that narrowness, and they don't want to think, they don't want to go and make decisions, they just want to go back. So it's a very tough for the family because they're never settled, they're never content in one environment. So, but I was, the seafarers are mainly from countries whose economies are struggling, like Eastern European, Philippines, Central America, sometimes Africa, Asia a lot. And they're, because they come from those countries because they're cheap labor, and the ship owners are not forced to pay them the fair wages. They can get away from paying not much, as opposed to the seafarers who come from North America or Northern Europe, whose contracts are well paid, well considered. We have to make a distinction between the U.S. flags, or flags that represent a country whose standards are fair, and the flag of convenience, who represent a country such as Liberia or Panama or the Bahamas, who are not protected. The seafarers are not with rights because their contracts are done without a supervision from the unions or from other representatives. Like, for instance, crew members under Panamanian flag are not subject to the minimum wages or to medical care, provisions for repatriation, a number of conditions that will improve or that will generate a good working conditions on board. Another distinction we should do is the cargo ships versus cruise ships. In a cargo ship, like David was saying, we normally find 20, 25 men, some women. And on a cruise ship, they're building them bigger and bigger. Now we see 5,000 people on a cruise ship. Can you believe 5,000? Among all passengers, and, yes. Crew members, 2,000. And there is this trend of building bigger and bigger. It reminds me like Babel. And the sea, they don't think that the sea is even bigger, that you know, they want to, I think it's so dangerous to bring all that power, that people into the ocean if the seas get rough, or, you know, have all these people over. But anyway, I never been on a cruise. And I don't want to be on a cruise. I don't like, well, it's not that I don't like, but I'm a little scared about the ocean and being among so many people. But the reasons why seafarers go at sea also are to nature. Whether they're forced because it's the only job there is back home and you don't need too much training for that, or the ones who really love to go to the sea. On the cruise ships, we have a lot of people from Central America. The most I meet are from Central America, Indonesia, and Philippines. They just need a job, and they, yes.
How do we don't have any cruise ships that go to the Philippines and Indonesia. How do those people get to be on the ships? How do they find those jobs?
There is a very sophisticated and slippery system of manning agents that recruit. They recruit all over the world, and they put ads, or they have offices. Sometimes through their governments, they put these ads recruiting labor, and many times the crew member has to pay high amount of dollars in order to come to work, in order to get a letter of employment, because they're so desperate back home that they've been told they're going to earn a lot of money on the cruise ships, and then the reality is different. They come and they work 12, 15 hours a day for $400 only. And so that's very deceiving, because
a month.
Mm-hmm. 400.
But they're paid in U.S. dollars. That's important. Seafarers worldwide are paid in U.S. cash. Mm-hmm. So a year ago, when the currency crisis hit Indonesia, for example, we were working with large numbers of Indonesians, and those people were still, because they were paid in dollars, they were okay. In fact, they were much better off than all the other people back home in Indonesia, because when they sent their money back home, it got the new exchange rate. Whatever's happening to your local currency, if you're paid in dollars, you can still put the same amount of bread on the table for your family.
So the seafarers, when they arrive in port, don't have much time off. They're once working on cruise ships, they have to prepare for the next lunch and pick up the luggage and put them in the cabins, and always working. It's always activity on the ship. So, and therefore, the ship arrives at 9 a.m. and leaves at 5, so they have just a few hours to rest, and the rest they have is to come to the local mission, us, and make their phone calls, because I would say, communication with their loved ones, finding out what happens at home, who, since they spend such a long time, they need to know what are the kids and what's the wife, what is everybody doing. So they call home, or they send a card or postcard, or they buy toothpaste, or they have, out of those $400, they have to buy toothpaste or shoes or shirts or for work. A Coca-Cola, so it goes a lot of money out in shopping too. The seafarers on cargo ships, since technology has developed so much, the system of loading and unloading is going quicker. And usually in the past, it will take 3 days to load a cargo, a container ship. Now with the cranes, it's done in few hours. So these men are all, they don't have the time to take pictures or go to Miami or go to the Everglades and relax. They are ready to go, and the ship owners, they want to the cargo move fast. So that's why it's very important that us, the church, goes to the ships and encounters the crew and say, what are your needs? Because a very important need they have is to be listened, to be heard. They don't realize that is that a need, but they have a lot of stories. They have difficult lives, they have experiences that need to be told. And for us to have the privilege to be there and listen without judging those stories, it's a very healing, very deep process of witnessing God's love and all that, what happens when you really listen carefully. I would say that it's a big need to listen. And that's why we need volunteers, because I'm not the only one who can listen. We empower all the volunteers and people who work at Seafarers House to be these greeters, these warm people who are there to smile and to say, yes, here I am. Then,
Mary?
Well, do you see the same person more than once?
Yes, we
yes
get
no.
Come back, you get to know them.
We get to see the same person more than once because they have a route. They have a, they go to New York and Halifax and then come back, and they have that maybe once a month or twice a month.
Well, although it depends. We see some cargo ships once and never again.
Right.
And we see some cargo ships that are liners and go back and forth to the Caribbean, and we see them every 14 days. The cruise ships are usually on a 7 or a 10 day schedule. So you can set up a regular relationship with those people.
Mm-hmm. Communications, since they live so isolated and in fear to open themselves to their colleagues, because their colleagues are their bosses or they are professionals, they don't rely, they don't trust anybody. So they need us. And they need their family, so Seafarers House has a lot of phones available. And we have a postal service where they can mail packages and stamps and buy certified letters. And another important service is to wire the money. Since they get paid in U.S. dollars, the family is waiting for that cash right away. And since they're not allowed to open bank accounts in the United States, we have the service to wire the money to their wife or their relative back home in 48 hours, very safe. So they trust us with their wages, with their money. Services that we have is essentially is to provide a safe haven, a place where they said it's okay to be here, to sit and relax, have a pool table and ping pong and some sofas and coffee, cookies. We have a chapel. It's a challenge to minister people from many faiths, like Muslims or Buddhists or non-Christians or even from another denomination, but we're there, and they don't ask who you are or what church you are. They just want a friendly face, a warm gesture, and we are, through the services that we provide, this is our way to say, here we are, and what else do you need?
You say that you meet their needs, physical needs, mental and emotional, but do you provide a worship service?
Yes, and that's what I was trying to say, because they come from many, many backgrounds and traditions and cultures. We cannot just impose and say, this is what you have to do. We have a quiet room, and it's a chapel. And I've been doing Bible studies and prayer services, and in Christmas and Easter and Holy Week, David does the Eucharist. And so they come, even if they're Catholics or they're Protestants, or we all gather.
The tremendous time pressures that people are on is something Maria used to hammer me about, and it really took me several years to appreciate how it perverts a person to work 15 hours a day, every day of your contract, without a day off. And that makes it very difficult for people when they come running in and they've got to send some money home, then they've got to buy their shaving cream in the store and some laundry detergent. They want to get on the phone, tell their wife that they've sent this $400 and it should be there in a day or two. And then she reminds them that their daughter's birthday's coming up, so they pick up a greeting card on the way out and fill it out quickly and take it to the post office and stand in line. We have a substation of the postal service in our facility. And maybe at that point on their way out, they hear the bell ringing and someone inviting them to worship. And it's tough. Although, I mean, that's the hard part about ministering there, is that people don't have much time. Now, if they got on the phone and learned that a parent died, they will find 15 minutes to go into the chapel with Maria or another counselor, or maybe just by themselves. And on the religious holidays. So the downside is people don't have much time to be there. The upside is that for me to celebrate midnight mass with Polish and El Salvadorian and Indian this past year and Filipino, you know, that kind of mixture is very exciting. And we have an overflow crowd on those occasions, largely because of the Roman Catholics who really feel very guilty that they haven't gotten to the Mass more often, and at least know that on this occasion it's an obligation. And afterwards they'll thank us so profoundly. Thank you. I don't know where else I would have been able to go. This year, Christmas Eve was... No, I guess it was Easter. Easter Eve. We did the first Mass of Easter morning at 12:30 a.m. Saturday night, kind of an Easter vigil. And afterwards, the Central Americans said, thank you, because there's a special cruise tomorrow. It's a holiday, and there's a very large Jewish population in Broward County. And so this particular ship, which does 1 or 2 day cruises, they said, we have a special cruise tomorrow. We're going to be working all day. We're working longer than usual on Easter Sunday. So they were really glad that Saturday night before they could come. So that's rewarding, that's gratifying. But it's tough to share the worship at other times.
Is everything you do in English?
No.
No.
This past Christmas Eve, I did an English service. You never know. That's the hard part. We showed up about 11:30, and it became clear at about 12:15 that we had a bunch of Christians from Goa, who wanted to go to the service. So we did. I did one in English, and then about 1:15 we did one in Spanish. It's not unusual. The night before I left last week, we were flooded by a cargo ship full of Chinese speakers. Russians are very common, but usually we can get by with English or Spanish, and all the worship that we do is in English and Spanish, although we stock Bibles in 15 or 20 languages.
Mm-hmm. Who supports you then? Does the Lutheran Church support you? Or?
We'll get to that in a minute when we talk about how we're organized. Maria's going to...
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I just wondered, if you weren't there, how would they do these things?
That's right.
Is there any other organization that helps the affairs?
No, that's a very good point. If we were not there, the seafarers will be wandering in the streets, trying to find their own way to make a phone call, putting quarters in a payphone, getting all messed up, going to a hotel, or who knows? It will be very, very sad to have nothing to offer to the stranger, to the people who are traveling and they're tired, because coming from the ocean, it's very confusing where things are. It's not the same as driving or walking in a city. You can have an idea, but from the sea, from the ocean, arriving into a known place, so how do you avoid getting into trouble, into the worst place? And one of the things that I forgot is that the society has this concept of crew members, of seafarers, like bad people, not trusting, or they're womanizers, or drunks, or they're tough, or they fight. But it's a myth. It's a myth that from maybe it was in the past, but these days is far, far from reality, because you see almost like farmers. You see people who have never been on the ship before. And they're there because they need money, and they need dollars, because that makes up better in their countries. So you see very naive, very vulnerable people who are often disoriented and ashamed, because it's not quite their place, and they're feeling insecure. And so,
do other countries have similar ministries? I mean, does the church
other countries? Yeah, this is an international network, and all over the world, they can find this. But for us, it makes sense that the churches get together and work together in one ministry, because imagine how ugly it will be in a port to have here the Catholics, here the Baptists, and here the Episcopalians, and all these little stores and ministries and the seafarers. In some ports, they are in competitions for the seafarers, all these denominations. And they go, oh, it's mine. And they go to the ship and pick them up and see who's first. And so we have to make an effort and be united and offer this response as a church, as one church. A couple of other services that we provide is transportation, since they don't have cars or motorcycles or anything. From the ship, which is usually out there in the bundocks, far from the city, they need transportation, someone that picks them up and takes them to the city and to the center. So that's very important. We have several vans.
Well, how do you get 2,000 crew people? I suppose they don't know.
Well, the 2,000, they can never, ever be away at the same time.
I'm not sure which ship Maria is referring to. The largest cruise ship in the world right now is the Grand Princess. And its captain told me
2,000.
The crew are 1,150, and the passengers are 2,400.
Well,
they're coming. They're getting closer to 5,000 all the time, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Well, I thought I had read that 5,000.
Maybe projected. But the Grand Princess is the largest in the world right now.
Are you sure? Mm.
Well, that's big enough.
That's big enough. That's 3,600 people, 1,150 crew. At least half of them will be working at any given time.
And at least.
But we don't. We run two 15-passenger vans and a little school bus, one of these small miniature school buses that a church gave us, a Lutheran church gave us. And we rent an additional van on the busy days. We run four vehicles in a shuttle, and they're busy.
Do you provide medical services when needed?
No, we don't.
Yeah, we have.
We have a referral.
Cruise ship will have a doctor on board,
yeah,
but it happens that a crew member comes to us and says, listen, I got this terrible problem, and I went to the doctor on the cruise ship, and he just told me to keep working, gave me aspirin, and told me I'd be all right. And I really think something else is wrong with me. In that situation, we will help the person get a second opinion.
Okay.
We'll take them to. But for the most part, they receive the medical care that they need.
Even on the cargo ships?
And on the cargo ship, too. That's an obligation of the company. Now, we find companies that have abandoned their crew or who aren't meeting their obligation. And in those situations...
I happen to disagree. that for the most part, they do not get the proper medical care.
On the cargo ships?
On the cruise ships.
On the cruise ships?
Mm-hmm. On the cruise ships.
Oh, okay. Why?
Because they are cheap labor, and they're as long as they work hard and everything is okay. When they get like an hernia or a muscle pinch or a heavy toothache or they hurt their thumb, they're very restless and uncomfortable. What shall we do? Because if they send it to a specialist, it's going to cost them money. And the specialist might tell them, well, this needs therapy or it needs surgery. And it's more care and more investment. And it's a complication. So they send the message that if you're sick, you're sent home.
You're out.
If you're sick, you're out. And they...
So there aren't any benefits. There's just...
There are no benefits. If you work for 25, 30 years in the same company, you go home the same way you came.
Ooh.
And that's the way it works. If you like it, okay, stay. But if you don't like it, go home because there are many people waiting for your job.
Mm-hmm.
And so they live with this fear that if they speak up, they're going to be sent home because there are many people waiting. So they keep with this pain in their tooth and until it gets worse and worse. And then if, like she said, if we were not there, they would have to go home. But if they come to us, and that's another service we provide, is referral, legal referral. We can say to the lawyer, this young man has a tooth problem and needs surgery, and the company doesn't want to listen to him. So the lawyer calls the company and say, such and such needs to see a doctor. And then the company will take him to the doctor. And until he's okay, he doesn't have to go home.
But if the seafarer, let's say he has to go and have surgery in a hospital because of a and the ship pulls up, they leave him there?
Yes, they leave him in the...
They pick him up 7 or 9 or 10 days later.
Or fly him to where the ship is.
Or fly him in.
But the international convention is that you should provide maintenance and cure in the port where the problem was diagnosed.
Oh.
Some of the more less reputable companies will try and do is send the person home to Honduras, where medical care is much cheaper.
What usually happens is when once you have made a complaint to the company,
mm-hmm.
you don't have a job anymore.
Huh? Through the legal channels.
Through the legal channels. They you're not friendly to the company, therefore, yes, we're going to put a remedy in your sickness, but you're out.
Would you say $400 is a fair wage in those economies?
It's an attractive wage in those economies. What people get seduced by is usually the promise of a higher wage. Keep in mind, they're recruited by a manning agent who's nowhere to be found when they show up on the ship and are given $400 a month instead of $800 a month that the Manning agent said you're probably going to get. So they get seduced by that. Secondly, $400 a month translated into Limpiras in Honduras sounds like a lot of money. But they have no idea what it's going to cost them to maintain themselves. You know, they haven't anticipated what they're going to spend on telephone calls back home to their family, the laundry detergent, the shoes, the daily, the clothing. So they don't they rarely have as much left over as they thought they were going to. But the wage is in itself attractive enough to recruit. And 400 is, that's at the lower end.
That's at the lowest.
Some people make much better than that, but we know a lot of people who work for 400. We know some who work for less.
I'm not familiar with cruise ships, but the cruise ship, there must be somebody on the ship that is in charge of making the contract to bring these workers on.
Well, the cruise ship company, the cruise company will contract with a Manning agent. Say, send me 15 hotel workers who speak English. And then the Manning agent in Honduras will recruit those people, charge another fee to them. That's illegal, but everybody looks the other way, unless it happened. The Manning agent will collect from the crew member for the letter of employment, promising him a job, send him up to Miami, put them in a hotel, tell the cruise company, grabs them and puts them on the ship. The cruise company will also pay the Manning agent for the supply of the 15 workers. So the Manning agent collects from two sides.
Where is it that keeps these, so low?
The global labor pool. Just the fact that people are so desperate. I mean, think about what's happening in Honduras after the hurricane. It's unbelievable. And we see people who had worked, you saw a case not too long ago of a man who had worked on a ship, swore he would never do it again, went back home, struggled with some farming or something like that. The hurricane wiped it out totally.
Oh, yeah.
So here he is back for another contract on board the ship.
Okay.
May I ask another question? I don't want to have you digress from your agenda, but I would be interested in knowing how, Maria, you got started or interested in seafaring ministry. You're a woman from Spain.
Right.
And how you ended up in Florida ministering to seafarers. So if you could
very briefly. I had done some sailing in Spain, and I was attracted to life at sea. How picturesque, how interesting it is. And I had a kind of an unfinished business with the person who worked at sea. And then in New York and in seminary, I wanted to reflect on that unfinished story with that man. And sort of it was a good opportunity to go back to the sea and see in perspective what was the environment and where, kind of come back and get healed, finish the story and come back. And so what it moved me to inquire in seminary about a chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. A chaplaincy, they had this internship in the Port of New York, New Jersey, with the Siemens Church Institute, and I applied to that chaplaincy, and I was approved, and so I was trained as a port chaplain, and be able to reflect and be with the people on another level, and with the at the light of the scriptures, and so it was worth it, and then I met David and all that. But David has a very good story to tell.
Thank you. Florida has more ports with more merchant seafarers and less maritime ministry than any other place in North America, for some reason I don't understand. The Siemens Church Institute of New York and New Jersey, where Maria got started, is 175 years old. Philadelphia is 150 years old. Los Angeles is 125 years old. There's one in Rhode Island. And those are just the Anglican or Episcopal institutions, which tend to call themselves Siemens Church Institute of. The Catholics call it Apostleship of the Sea or Stella Maris, Star of Mary. Lutherans sometimes go by the name of Bethel Ministry. when we So that's why New York sent Maria down to see if she could get something started, because there was a consciousness of a tremendous shipping industry there. A lot of the trade with Latin America and happens out of South Florida. When we came, she stayed 2 years, went back to New York, we met and married and came back together to develop a ministry which in July of 91 had never had an employee. Today there are 35. Was open about 24 hours a week. Today we're open 130 hours a week, 18 hours a day, at least every day of the year. Was staffed with volunteers, about 15 or 20 good regular monthly volunteers. Last year in this book, this annual report, copies of which are over here, we list our volunteers. I think last year was about 122. So I want to focus for a moment, not to blow our horn so much as to share a model for how ministry got started with virtually no institutional church funding. A little bit. The Episcopal Diocese of Southeast Florida put in $10,000, I think, each of the first 2 years, and then went to $3,000, and then after that, nothing, although the bishop makes an occasional $1,000 grant out of discretionary funds. We've never received any funding from Lutheran sources except individual congregations and individual Lutherans. I don't want to say that the Lutherans don't support us at all. I have a call from the Florida Bahamas Synod Council. I'm an ELCA clergy. I have a call to serve to do ministry in a specialized setting from the Synod Council. Now, that doesn't cost the Synod Council anything, except I'm one of, you know, a few hundred clergy who have to be taken care of, but that they don't put any pension money or any salary money into that. All that comes from the board at Seafarers House. We still have hopes of getting some money there, but one of the things we give up by being an ecumenical ministry is denominational funding. The Lutheran Maritime Ministries, the maritime ministries that get funding from the National Lutheran Church are Lutheran maritime ministries. We stopped getting money from the Episcopal Diocese in Southeast Florida when we became an ecumenical ministry, because they said, well, you're not an Episcopalian ministry. Why should we fund you? Now, we went ecumenical because we said it doesn't make sense for every church to try and support this. The Episcopal Church can't provide all the funding. You know, better to be ecumenical and draw support from a variety, but so much church funding is so parochially organized, it makes it very tough. Who funds us? The largest single source of financial support we get is from the Seafarers in two ways. They make donations. We have a seafarer right now who's coming in about every 5 or 6 weeks with $200-$300 at a time, and he says, my church discipline back home in Central America is to tithe. And while I'm working here on the ship, I think you're my church. I'm going to offer my tithe to you. And this year he's given over $500 himself. In our vans, there's a little bucket that says gas money. Our vehicles before the payroll cost us $28,000 last year. And seafarers contribute to that. They provide tips in the center. But actually, the largest single source of funding from them comes from the services that they buy from us. They pay for their phone calls. They pay for their shaving cream. They pay to wire their money home. Now, this is a philosophy that I'm a big proponent of. Poor people have an economy. They spend money. They usually spend more for the same services than you and I do. And there is a mentality common among us, ministers and church workers, that, well, we have to be careful. We shouldn't be engaged in commerce with the people we want to serve, or we shouldn't be profiting from them. And this is a regular argument at the Port Chaplains Conference that we'll be at next week, which happens this year to be held in Seattle. I argue strongly that it's good as a minister, to involve yourself with the economy of the people you want to serve. One, to help them. In Port Everglades today, crew members pay a tiny fraction for a phone call of what they used to pay before we came along. I mean, we have dramatically lowered the cost. People, I remember when we launched a phone card and we dropped our price to the Philippines to a flat $1.25 per minute. And this was just unheard of, that the Filipinos were going to call home for $1.25 a minute. Today, that same phone card sells a minute to the Philippines for 39 cents. It's 33 cents out of our phone room. But if you buy a phone card and use it from any payphone, a prepaid phone card, it's 39 cents. I'm proud of that. But that takes involving ourselves with their economy, doing it in a business smart way, so that, now, the second reason why I believe in this philosophy is that it makes us loyal to their interests. I worked for a while for the National Episcopal Church as a grant maker, and I would go around and evaluate funding applications, first in Africa and then later in the United States, from people who wanted funds to run a congregation, a parish-based ministry. And I learned to tell the difference between a ministry which can tell, may be very popular at its church convention, may be well known by every church in the diocese or in the synod for doing a great job because at the last convention somebody stood up and told this heartwarming story about what happens down in the port. I know poor chaplains who tell those stories very well, and the seafarers tell us are almost impossible to find in their port. That's just the reality. The way we're organized, if we don't have thousands of seafarers coming through our door, buying services from us that they need, then economically we don't exist. So another reason for involving yourself with the economy of those people is that, you know, obviously our goal is not to make a profit. Our goal is to work off of the thinnest possible margin that contributes something to our overhead, but provides a great service to. If we don't have huge numbers coming through our doors, then we fail as an institution. We can't meet our payroll. We had this past winter, every Sunday, Sunday was the busiest day of the week for the cruise industry in Port Everglades this past year. We had, we believe, about 1,500 people per day go through our facility. And we just crowd it to the... Now, is that the best way to do ministry? I don't know. It's one way we have effectively been able to provide a lot of services to a lot of people. What haunts me is the thought that if 1,500 people go through there in a day, how many got bad news on the phone and got out the door before any of us ever really were able to be with them? We find out. We train the people at the counter who work that call accounting computer that keeps track of 48 lines that are going continuously. People walk in, get a key, go, the key gives them dial tone, and they dial away and talk as long as they want. And when they come off, the computer, you know, you go to booth 34 and you see what calls the guy's made and you print a little receipt. And if he's in tears, we try and, we have an internal communication system where we try and let the chaplain on duty at the time know that, you know, this guy might have gotten some bad news on the phone. If he's not in tears, we train all the volunteers to say, did you talk to your family today? Yeah. How are they? Oh, fine. Thank God. The Central Americans always say, gracias a Dios. Thank God. And that's the high moment of their week. It really is. So to have somebody who doesn't just want to, you know, say $15.34, please, but who actually says, you know, what happened on that phone call? Provides the human dimension, the ministry dimension, that lets them know we care about them as a human being. So we work to improve their economy, and that has been responsible for the largest single source of operating funds. For capital funds, the money to put up the building or to buy the van as opposed to putting the gas in it and paying for the insurance and paying the driver. Capital funds, poor chaplains have access to a very good deep pocket source in London called the International Transport Workers Federation. The ITF runs a seafarers trust fund, very wealthy, and they've learned that the best way to provide grants that translate into direct services for crew members is through the worldwide network of port chaplains. They love us because of Maria. Maria is one of the, she would never say this, but she is really one of the best in this country at seafarers' rights work. And she has a huge reputation among crew members for the author of this book called Trouble on Board, which I'll pass around the room, tells a story in here about finding a seafarer in the northeastern part of the United States at one point who had laminated a photocopy of Maria's business card that he had picked up somewhere. And he had made a photocopy of it and laminated it and carried it in his wallet. And Paul knew Maria, was one of her mentors, and said, "Oh, do you know Maria?" And he said, "No, I've never met her. But I heard that if I ever get into trouble, I can call her." Collect. We got a call, collect from Heathrow Airport in London at 3 a.m. one day. And somebody was looking for Maria because he was in trouble. So the ITF loves us because of the advocacy work that we do, and they have provided generous grants for building or for vehicle. Now, that's not the whole thing. We run special events. We just did a black tie dinner honoring the head of Holland America Cruise Line. Here's where it starts to get a little more ambiguous, you know. In this case, Holland America is one of the better run companies, and they had been very good to us. They give us a cruise ship every fall. It'll be December 10th this year. When they give us the ship, and through the local Chamber of Commerce, we put together the Broward, we live in Broward County, the Broward Business Leaders Luncheon. And it's a networking luncheon among business leaders who come on board the ship. They get a champagne cocktail reception. We make a speech. The company makes a speech about how glad they are to help us because we're helping their crew. We make a speech about what we do, and everybody says, "Oh, I never heard of that. That's very interesting. I never thought about that." The company attracts to its ship well-heeled business leaders who gawk at this beautiful ship and then run right home and buy a cruise. And then they serve a first-class luncheon with wine and salmon and pork chops and whatever, you know. And we sell tickets to that luncheon. We raised about $18,000 that way last year. Because of that, when we decided to go to the cruise industry this year for our black tie dinner, we chose the head of their company. It wasn't particularly good choice. We struggled a little bit, but we netted $110,000 from that black tie dinner evening. And more importantly than that, we put our name on the map. Special events are a very hard way to raise money. They're just a lot of energy, and they're very unreliable from year to year. But they are a great way to introduce yourself to the community if nobody knows you. And that was our case. We were brand new. And we had built the agency with a terrific relationship with crew members in the port, but outside the port, we are still largely unknown. And when we started our special events 3 years ago, we were virtually unknown. So special events, when I get back in July, I've been working the last couple of months, and we'll work some more this summer on trying to bring onto our staff for the first time a professional fundraiser. And that take us to the next level as an agency. When we got there in 91, the budget was about $100,000, and I would say $85,000 of that was the phone bill. So, you know, it was a very small run operation. Today, we say that our operating budget is about $700,000, but we actually handle about $10 million in funds a year. $5 or $6 million of that is just the money remittances. The $700,000 budget only counts what we earn for selling money orders or wire transfers, about $45,000 last year. So, you know, do you count $5.5 million or do you count $45,000? You know, it depends on what you're trying to say. If you just, the $700,000 includes the phone bill from the phone room, probably about $300,000 of that. The rest is staff. Now, one of the things that I want to emphasize is the way in which we took very consciously the attitude in the two principles. One, we're going to involve ourselves with their economy. What do they spend their money on? Phone calls. Let's help them do that cheaper. And we are. Secondly, Maria and I said the typical mistake that a port chaplain makes is that they do the ministry and busy their lives very quickly and get burned out eventually and don't serve any more people than the number of hours in the day allow them to do. We were conscious that we were going to try and organize a ministry that empowered the ministry of other people. And that means that I don't get nearly the contact with crew members that I might like. And I certainly don't do much pastoral work with them. Maria's our chaplain. She does a certain amount of that. But the bulk of what we do is done by other employees and volunteers whom we have called and trained and provide an infrastructure from which to do ministry. Most of our employees find their first job in the United States with us. We have, actually he just left our staff, but all winter long one of our drivers, Rod, is a Cuban refugee who was rescued by a cargo ship in the Florida Straits. He built a makeshift little raft, set sail from Cuba trying to get to Florida, got lost, was in a lot of trouble for his life, and a cargo ship going by saw him and rescued him. Now, do you think that guy's motivated to be a welcomer of the strangers who arrive on cargo ships at Port Everglades? We have a number of we don't have a Honduran on the staff right now. We have Colombians, Dominican Republic. We have a Haitian man.
Philippines.
Several Filipinos, thank you. That's an extra challenge, but also an exciting part of what makes Seafarers House very special. It is the most multicultural, multiracial, multilingual place I know of anywhere, in this country at least. For the number of, last time we counted, we spoke 12 languages among our employees.
So you have someone that's able to converse?
Not always. We don't have a Chinese speaker right now. But that cargo ship of Chinese will have a radio officer on board, and the radio officer's job is to be able to speak different languages. So he'll come with the group and translate, or the ship that was there the night before, they spoke some English. Some Chinese ships don't speak any, some Russians don't speak any. But you want to make a phone call, you know, and people will be, yes, the numbers always work. But it is a tremendously diverse environment. It's multi-faith now. We have added to our board of directors this year a Muslim imam and a Jewish rabbi. And that was that has strong support from the Christian leadership on our board, which says if we want to be a ministry in public space, then we should, it'll be easier, we will be freer to be ministers as far as the public consciousness of this divide church and state land. We will be freer to do ministry if we're doing it on behalf of a variety of faiths in our community who come together to look after people that are strangers. The Jewish rabbi kept saying, why, you know, why? There are no, do you serve Jews? I said, well, not very many, you know. I mean, you can tell by the phone bill, and we don't make very many calls to Israel every month. Few, but not too many. So, well, why should we be involved? And what? And I was having lunch with him. I had to go through about three scenarios before I hit one that worked for him. And the one that worked for him was that this is an overlooked group of people serving our community who fall through the cracks. And his faith and theology had taught him that, yeah, that's good to do. We're atypical for the multi-faith approach we're taking. I don't know of another sister agency that would do that, and for the most part, many of them will not. While they are more open to other faiths than other groups of ministers, in my experience, because I think they have the contact. You serve Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus, and you get to know that there are good Muslims and Muslims who are not as nice to be with, just like there are better and worse Christians. And you have to wonder at the end of the day, you know, how does God look on a Christian who was baptized and might go to church on Christmas and Easter, but beats his wife and gets drunk all the time? Is that really preferred in God's eyes to a Muslim who's very dedicated to reading the scriptures and is a God-fearing Man, I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to make that judgment. I do know that I think it's right for us to be going off in a new direction here and making it a multi-faith ministry. And I will say that a surprise for me since we took the step has been the way in which it allows me to, in public spheres, because we don't get as much support from churches as we'd like, to be honest with you. One of the reasons is they say, well, you guys are doing so well. We have this other ministry over here that's just really struggling, and they're about to close their doors. And, you know, I kind of say, maybe their doors need to close. And maybe people in your congregations would provide more support for your social outreach ministries if you supported good, strong ministries instead of propping up some that, you know, aren't really doing a very good job and ought to close. Not that all the struggling ones, that's their story. But that is the case sometimes. Could we use more support from churches? You bet. My godmother in a Missouri Synod church in St. Paul, Minnesota, is on fire with interest for what we do. She took a cruise out of the Port of Miami a couple of years ago and came in a day early and visited us. And she's got people using the videotape that we looked at last week with a study guide in their churches. She's got them, the Sunday school, baking cookies and shipping them down to us. They're knitting hats and scarves. They're raising, you know, offerings once in a while and sending it our way. If we had a few more churches sending cookies, we'd have them all the time instead of once a month. And that would that's a nice, friendly feature for people who come in. We're busiest this summer now when the cruise ships have gone to Alaska or to the north. We're busiest late at night after the day cruise ship comes back from about 11:30 until about 1:30. And those guys come in, men and women come in and find a homemade cookie and know that we're not a business trying to get their money, but a ministry trying to share God's love with some wonderful human beings that get overlooked and trampled on. Appreciate the fact. Know that it's a place with a chapel that has the big heart for them. Lastly, and very quickly, the largest undeveloped part of our ministry is that of ministry to the worldview of our community. Dottie is a 55-year-old real estate agent in Fort Lauderdale who's a confirmed monolinguist. We have this type in Florida. People who are determined never to speak anything but English, you know, and why aren't, in South Florida, this is a tension for people because Spanish is the dominant language now. And she was a confirmed monolinguist until she came and started working with us as a volunteer and got to know these people. And she came to me one day and said, you know, working here has made me kind of want to take a Spanish class and at least be able to greet these people in Spanish. That's also part of our ministry. Or to work with people. I've seen some self-righteous volunteers come in and they corner a guy and say, why do you leave your family? You know, he comes off the phone and he's crying and why, oh, my family, I haven't seen them for so long and I feel so bad. Well, why do you leave them? Why don't you go back home? And, well, the jobs don't pay there in dollars. Well, what difference does it make? You don't need the dollars there. You spend lempiras, right? And then they get a little less lesson in economics about what's happening to the lempira and how it has lost its value over the last 2 months compared to the dollar, which holds its value. And that's a ministry to us as well. Or just the contract across racial lines. The Jamaican men who have a very soft spot, but they like to swagger and wear the gaudy jewelry, and they're big, strong black men. And there are volunteers who come out of our white churches who are a little afraid of that. But you work at our counter for a while, and talk to some of those Jamaican men when they've come off the phone after talking to their mother, and you'll learn to love them too. So we have a ministry to the worldview of the community and to the hard life of the seafarers who serve us, and it's been a treat to share it with you because we're so excited about it.
Great. Thank you.
There's a lot of literature over there. The most complete source of information is the annual report. There are some one-page descriptions and a newspaper article. Please take it with you if you'd like to read it so we don't have to ship it back to Seabury's house. And thanks for